Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim, my co-hosts. Gents, good to be back again.
Good to see you.
Yeah, good to catch up again this week.
Well, a Gaza agreement has meant that perhaps there's a route, finally, to peace in the Middle East. At least that is what the hope of Donald Trump, the US president, is after he brokered an agreement between Israel and Hamas, which has seen the exchanging of hostages and prisoners and a ceasefire after 2 years of a brutal, brutal war in the Gaza Strip. Of course, it started on the 7th of October 2023 with that horrific attack by Hamas on Israeli soil, killing over 1,000 people and holding hundreds of hostages. And then the onslaught on the Palestinian people in Gaza, killing more than 70,000 by official records, but the likeliness that it is much, much more, of course, weighs deeply on everyone's hearts. Ozan, let's start with you. The ceasefire is in place. Hostages and prisoners have been exchanged. Donald Trump is claiming victory. How are you putting sense or making sense of what is happening? I guess is the first question. And the second, is this a step towards a broader peace plan in the Middle East?
Look, I think, put simply, this is a victory for Donald Trump. It is a big win. I think he can claim with some credibility now that he has resolved a conflict, albeit in the short term, but he's certainly brought about a ceasefire. Now, that doesn't mean long-lasting peace or a two-state solution, as we've discussed in the last couple of weeks. On Put Simply, there's a long way to go before this peace will, I think, hold. It's quite fragile, if you ask me. It really depends on whether Hamas agrees to many of the ceasefire conditions that that have been put in place. Of course, the most important one of those being that Hamas has to unarm or and hand over the administration of Gaza to a bureaucratic body and technocrats, effectively, without the influence of politics. These are things, I think, that time will tell whether it is put in place. But look, it is, by all accounts, probably a big win, I think, for Donald Trump. Will this have an influence on his domestic political standing? I don't think so. But at least when he's running around saying that he's got, he's resolved, he made a speech to the Knesset and said that he's now resolved 8 conflicts since he's come into power and taken office in 8 months. He made a point of saying that this one has been a 3,000-year conflict. Now, all of us following this issue pretty closely know that this has been a very long-standing conflict, but yet to understand what he means by a 3,000-year conflict, considering one of the sides, one of the sides' religion hasn't been around for 3,000 years. So for us who kind of take words seriously and think about them, that's, I guess, one thing that you probably need to do a little bit more digging around to figure out what he actually means. But look, this is all trivial. At the end of the day, there's a lot to be, I think, happy about and hopeful about, because the hostages have been returned back, and I believe that the bodies of those who are deceased, so hostages, are slowly being returned back to their families in Israel. I think that's causing some frustration because it's not happening quickly enough. And, you know, Gazans, for the first time in 2 years, can have some hope that there might be some effort to, first of all, provide security for them, but also to rebuild a piece of land that's been absolutely demolished by a senseless assault on many fronts by the Israeli armed forces. I think, yeah, it's a good step forward, but a long way to go. I think people need to get a little bit, put things into perspective. As I mentioned, this doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be a long-lasting peace, or is it going to mean, you know, down the track, that this is a kind of going in the direction of a two-state solution, which we all know is the way to deal with this in the long term. They're all questions that are yet to be answered. But I think, as I said last week, I would much rather be here, and I'm pretty sure the Gazans and the Israelis would much rather be here than where they were, you know, 3-4 weeks ago.
And Rodney, one of the questions we've often asked in looking at a ceasefire or a road to peace of some sort in the Middle East is what's in it for Hamas, right? We obviously know to a certain extent what's in it for Israel to come to the negotiating table, given the hostage situation and the, I guess, the ongoing threat from Hamas as it sees from an Israeli government perspective. But what's in this particular deal for Hamas that have made them agree on at least, you know, for the time being, putting weapons down and they're returning the Israeli hostages?
Very little, to be honest. What they do have is the prospect of survival. They haven't been completely wiped out. They've got detainees and prisoners returned, which might help shore up their base. They're not absolutely out of the running to be a political influence in a future Palestinian state, right? I mean, the Palestinian Authority has been sidelined. The transitional entity might not include Hamas, but it won't include the Palestinian Authority either, and therefore there is an opportunity to rebuild and re-establish influence. We got to be clear, although there's been a ceasefire, killing in Gaza has continued, and there's been internal fighting as well, as they've sought to retain their position on the ground. And other weapons and so on are supposed to be surrendered as part of this. It's not small arms, so the ability to retain themselves as an armed entity and a political force is there. And look, and it's, even for Netanyahu, I mean, it was a huge climb down when he had to apologize to Qatar. That, in a sense, opened up the opportunity for Trump to put pressure on the Israelis. And again, that wasn't of Trump's making. It was an opportunity that he seized upon. And, you know, Netanyahu might look at the security outcomes, you know, in terms of Hezbollah being damaged, strikes in Yemen, Iran being weakened and so on. But I don't see that Israeli security is necessarily better off now than it was then from a longer term perspective, because they haven't won any friends in the region. They've alienated potential allies globally. And Netanyahu's clung on to power for a bit longer, and Trump can appeal for criminal charges against Netanyahu to be dropped during his speech in the Knesset. But it's a complicated picture, and there's an awful lot to play out, which means there's opportunity, because, you know, so many things remain unsettled or unresolved. But there's no clear victors apart from Trump at the inception of the plan. And to be honest, it wasn't much different than the previous plan. It's just that he took the opportunity when it arose, you know, in part driven by the Israeli attack on Qatar to move things forward. So a little bit of credit to Donald Trump this week.
I want to pick up on two things that Rodney said. I think are very important. Yes, there's nothing in it for Hamas, but also I think, you know, to give further credit to President Trump, I think he played it very well. It was a very well coordinated effort with Egypt, Turkey, I think even Qatar to a certain degree, of putting pressure on Hamas. Because let's face it, if, you know, as much as Hamas is in a very difficult position, it's fighting an existential kind of fight, and it needs the support of its traditional allies in Turkey, Qatar, and other places, even Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood kind of network. But I think Trump played it very well because he jumped on the whole, peace agreement has been, or a ceasefire agreement has been done, before waiting for Hamas to actually agree to all of the conditions of that peace deal. One of the ones I mentioned before being the most important, Hamas agreeing to disarm. They hadn't agreed to it before Trump went and declared victory, but it's kind of now forced them into a situation where they've seen they're losing their traditional allies, and I think they've been backed into a bit of a corner. And the second part that I wanted to pick up on was around what is the future for Benjamin Netanyahu? I think most people in the West, and I think a lot of people in Israel probably want to see the back of him, considering the appalling way he has handled this war in the last 2 years. So it's going to be very interesting to see his political future. And as Rodney mentioned, that Donald Trump appealed to the president in the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, saying that he should be pardoned. But this is a big issue because if, a future election, if he loses it, he loses his immunity and he's able to be prosecuted. And I'm not sure politically where he sits because he was effectively booed. I think it was... Might have been. I'm not sure who it was that was kind of giving a speech in public, and when Benjamin Netanyahu's name came up, the crowd was booing. He's got significant, dissent within his own people around the way he's handled the hostage situation. So I think Benjamin Netanyahu's days might be numbered, despite the fact that he's been able to, in the eyes of some people, almost destroy Hamas, and push a very right-wing agenda that certainly his coalition partners have been pushing. I'm not sure this is resonating all that well in Israel. So I think that's one to watch, and we can pick that up in further episodes.
Rodney, you mentioned the attack on Qatar, the Israeli ordered missile strike on Qatar, which had infuriated Trump at the time, and there's sort of lots of talks and even reports that he effectively made Netanyahu apologize. Now, in the light of what's happened over the last week then, what's in this for Trump? What's in it for the US? Because we know he has that, the America first sort of approach to everything. And for him, America's interests comes first, right? Beyond any other interest. What does he get out of this?
I think it's as superficial for him as being a contender for the Nobel Peace Prize in his mind for next year, if not this year. I think his motivation about describing himself as a peacemaker, continually listing all the wars that he solved, even ones that haven't happened or involved the wrong countries because his involvement was so insignificant. He's so desperate to be seen as someone who ends conflict. And I don't think it's because he has a particular issue about fairness and human rights and democracy, because you see what he's doing domestically. I think it's simply driven by his desire to be recognized for something that he has no or hasn't had any huge track record with, because one of his predecessors won something. He thinks he should have it as well. I think sometimes with Trump, we can overcomplicate the motivation. This does go straight, goes against America first and forever wars and foreign interference. But yeah, I think it's driven by vanity, and vanity to be recognized as this great peacemaker.
Look, I think, I completely agree. I think the politics of Donald Trump have been full of contrast since the moment he went down that escalator in 2015. So it's if you look at what he's doing domestically, as Rodney said, he's not, trying to end conflict. He's starting conflict in places like Chicago and other places. But it simply is He wants to be better than his predecessors, and I don't know if it's some sort of childhood or trauma that he suffered in his young adult life where he wasn't taken seriously by the people he views as elites, and it's him trying to kind of in his late 70s try and prove to people that actually, you know what, these I'm better than them, or you know, I've won this whole kind of conflict that he's been in and he's created with people like Obama and of course his direct predecessor Biden. It's really about trying to get one on them, really, at the end of the day. It's simple as that.
Like some sort of presidential imposter syndrome that he's wrestling against in his own head.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's you know, I think a therapist or a group of therapists would have a field day trying to get into his head and you know, analyze the way he thinks.
Well, that's more on the international stage for Trump, but let's turn domestically now and have a look at what's happening in the US that is still causing him some headaches. And indeed, of course, the entire population I'm referencing here, the government shutdown, which has now been 2 weeks in the making. Of course, this has happened many times before on both camps, or both political camps, I should say. But this particular one feels like a bit of an impasse that's not really resolving. Rodney, we've spoken about who will blink first and how we get out of it. The reality is now, of course, hundreds of thousands of federal workers are impacted. The US government effectively, in many ways, doesn't have the money to spend beyond essential services. And so there's talks of scaling back and cutting down on that side of stuff. But where are we at with the shutdown? And you know, where do you foresee sort of things going to be able to come to some sort of a resolution?
But both sides are continuing to dig in, is how I see it. Whether they can water down what the health care concessions that the Democrats are seeking are in order to get some sort of movement from Republicans, I simply don't know. And at least allow them to claim some victory in protecting some components of healthcare. But it does feel like the pain's starting to bite on the public. There have been people who have been losing their jobs, but at some point people are going to get really, really cross. And maybe we're starting to see that a little bit in the polls, but I don't think we're very high up the mountain of how cross they can get with respect to this. And I don't see that the Republican plan to sort of scapegoat the Democrats for it is working in their favor at the minute. Therefore, the Democrats seem to be on better ground with protecting healthcare, and the Republicans look as if they're taking advantage of it to get rid of federal workers. And we'll see what happens, but I don't think we're looking at this being resolved in the next few days, especially because Donald's off to fix Ukraine and Russia next. He's not really focused domestically, it doesn't seem.
I'm following the, and I never thought I would say this in my life, but I'm following the Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of line of thought on this.
Your favorite politician.
I've become a big fan of her, so you know, I won't let you say a bad word about her. Jokes aside, she's called it the way I think. She's basically said what a lot of Republicans are thinking in private and are probably too scared to voice. She said that you know, the shutdown is effectively very badly hurting the Republican Party and the chances of the Republican Party in the midterm elections, which are in about just over a year, in November next year. So I think the politics is of this, from my assessment, is not playing out all that well for the Republicans. I think trying to, as Rodney said, cut federal government employees and looking like they're using the shutdown to do that, I think is not good politics at all. As we discussed last week, I think the Democrats are on much stronger ground when it comes to pushing for to maintain people's health insurance. So I don't think the politics are all that good for the Republicans. And you know, it's not really all that much showing in the polls at this point in time. But what is clear is that Donald Trump's approval rating is on a downward trend and has been very quickly. So it's very difficult, obviously, to isolate one issue or one reason for that. I think it's probably a kind of different groups of or different factors that are playing there. So yeah, I think you know, and Donald Trump or the administration has suffered a bit of a setback with a federal judge overnight saying that putting a block on his ability to use the shutdown as a means to cut more jobs. So I think that's a bit of a setback. And the Senate, I think, voted last night for the ninth time to try and move this budget bill forward, and they need five Democrats. So I think they've got four. So they need five Democrats to get to 60 votes, which are the number of votes that are required to pass this bill. But it doesn't look like any of those Democrats are budging or moving. You've got Fetterman, who's a senator from Pennsylvania. He seems to be the most vocal Democrat against this shutdown, which I think is very silly. I think he's misjudged the politics of this. The others seem to be, and look, they don't have really any incentive to move. They know that they can keep this their stance, because most of the Democrats are not, you know, the only one really, I think, is in Georgia that's going to be facing the people in 2026. But you know, most of the Democrat seats that are up for grabs are not super close. So there's no incentive politically for the Democrats to back off or any of these senators to back off. So I think it's a, you know, you saw Bernie Sanders and AOC did a CNN town hall. You know, I caught some of it, and they looked strong. Like, I think they got a very clear message out there. Now, of course, who's going to watch CNN? But that's not the point. You know, they have a very, very active, particularly AOC, social media campaign that they run around the clock. So, you know, a lot of this will get out, and you know, the Democrats seem to be back in business. And you know, it's taken a while for them to kind of find their footing, but they seem to be, I think, getting some points on the board. It will also be interesting this week is the No Kings rally that's going to be held. If you remember, there was another one that was held in, I think, June, around the time when Donald Trump was running his military parade, and they got millions of people across the country attending this. So it'll be very interesting to see how many people attend over the weekend, because you know, I think people are starting to get very concerned about what's going on. And, you know, a lot of the things coming out of Chicago, a lot of those scenes, I think, you know, there seems to be a growing discontent with what's going on.
Yeah, it was a point that I was going to pick up with you, Rodney. I mean, we've spoken about when you deploy troops to a city, effectively the crime stops, right? I mean, if you put the military on the streets of any city and you have this sort of crackdown, generally speaking, particularly true in Western societies, who perhaps might not be used to that level of powerful display of force, that's particularly true. And we've seen that in the US. You know, Caroline Leavitt, the US press secretary, has come out many times, or the White House press secretary, I should say, saying that, you know, crime's effectively stopped in Washington, D.C. It's a crime-free city, etc. Chicago's obviously next on his streets, Trump's books. But do you feel that at some there's a turning point with the community? At some point, they stop seeing this as a credible way, or an effective way, rather, of stopping crime, and now just it all starts to perhaps look a little bit silly.
No, I'm going to say no, because when I grew up in Belfast, there was a significant permanent military presence on the streets. And what happens very quickly is it becomes a pretty normal environment to go about your daily business. And therefore, whether you're going to work, schools, leisure activities, and so on. And there is this backdrop. People adapt pretty quickly and just get on with things. So I suspect that it'll look more normal to people than abnormal over time. And unless there's incidences where there's a huge overstep by the military, or there's some unlawful conduct or something like that, I suspect that this is going to just continue to roll on, and that rather than protest it, that people, providing it's not impacting on their own lives in a direct way by preventing them doing something that they normally do, will just sort of accept it as part of the environment. I may be wrong, and maybe America, won't accept it, but that's my sense of it, because I think that people can adapt very easily to changes as environment, and they quickly forget what it was like before that happened.
I mean, I completely agree with that sentiment that, people have got the, the memory of a goldfish these days when it comes to issues and politics, et cetera. But a part of me also thinks that in the US context, it's a bit unique, I think. This is a country that's brought about a, the Second Amendment, the right to arm, and to bear arms. And when those people who are questioning the relevance of this and what have you, and it's considered as a constitutional right, but also many people are, I want to be able to protect myself when the government against the government, and that was certainly one of the founding kind of principles of it. But I think there's still a mentality there that, US, the optics of the army on US streets, I think probably worries or concerns or upsets Americans more than it might in other countries, particularly around, made up and often completely fictional reasons, and many of the reasons why that the administration's using around the need to bring in the National Guard to Chicago, because ICE agents, are apparently getting hassled, and they're being prevented from being doing their job because there's a radical left Antifa, anti-fascist movement that's been funded by George Soros and everyone else, etc. Like, they've just created this made up narrative that Chicago is a is out of control, and there's war on the streets of Chicago. Hence, the National Guard needs to come in. If I'm not wrong, Chicago just hosted its annual marathon. It doesn't sound like a city that's kind of, needs to be put into martial law or anything. So I think people are going to see through that, and they're going to be a bit uncomfortable with it. I completely agree with your sentiment around people really kind of adapting to their environment, but this might be crossing a red line with the American people, I think.
Apparently, someone won the marathon by setting a record because they were running away from ICE officials. That's the.
I thought you might go there.
Yeah. I don't know whether that was a credible news source, but I did hear that.
Well, it would make sense. So.
So you mentioned this earlier, Rodney, but I mean, Trump didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize this year. It was kind of expected, and you correctly said that there was no chance that he was going to win it. Was he kind of expecting it? And I guess, does it still put him in the running for next year? Because it sounds like it's a big deal for him.
I think he was ex there's a little bit of him expecting it, just as the kid at Christmas who thinks they're going to get a Ferrari. There's a little bit of hope that just gets killed at the last moment when the big reveal takes place. But he does seem to have got some comfort from the fact that the winner said that actually Trump deserved it, and said that she was accepting it on behalf of both of them. And that was good politics from the Venezuelan opposition, not least because she needs American help in overthrowing the current government, so she can claim political office in Venezuela and right the wrong of the last election. So yeah, it I don't think he was as cross about it as he could have been, but we'll know in the next few weeks when he starts to impose sanctions on Norway or something. or make some friends.
I thought it
Dartsman
was
kiddos.
a I thought it was an astute, very astute decision by the Nobel Committee, because they effectively, and you can judge how smart it was by his response, and his response wasn't thermonuclear. And I think the lady who won it from Venezuela, the opposition leader, had a lot to do with that response, but also he quickly, I think, got over his disappointment and saw that this actually plays straight into to kind of his political agenda and what he wants to do with Venezuela. So I think the Nobel Committee actually, did the best thing they could by awarding this lady with it, because it kind of it took the toxicity out of what could have been a very, very poisonous and toxic response by him if they had awarded it to someone else, some random organization.
Does that mean his lobbying did affect the outcome then, even though it wasn't in his favor?
Well, anyway, she might have been the compromise candidate.
So yeah, so basically he did influence the outcome.
Yep,
Well,
maybe
look,
so.
there's also plenty of opportunity for his other wars to go wrong, or his other conflict resolution efforts to go wrong over the next few months. So I wouldn't be betting on him winning next year.
Well, there's no conflicts left that he can fix, mate. We're living in
You have to
total global
start
peace
some.
now. Yeah, exactly. It's a it's peace abroad, but war
We're at
within is the
home.
motto.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of some form of war within, I guess we were talking about Japan last week on this podcast, Ozan, and suddenly it was about to make history in more ways than one. But politics seems to have got a little bit more complicated in that country. Talk us through what's going on.
Well, I thought you might have jumped on my. I was giving you an assist there, mate, with the compromise candidate. I thought you might have jumped on with that, but yes, there is politics in Japan right now is in complete flux, and we discussed this last week on the show, and it was looking like very clearly that the LDP had selected, or were about to, on the verge of selecting the first kind of woman prime minister in Japan, and that looks like it's that plan looks like it's not going to go ahead as they had planned. So the Liberal Democratic Party has been in power for the last 13 years. They've been in a coalition for quite a number of those years with a party called Komeito, which is one of the smaller opposition parties. And the thinking was that Ms. Takaichi Sanae would win the leadership of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party and be able to breeze through to being elected in the parliament as the prime minister. But that whole plan came to a sudden end with the coalition, minor coalition party, walking away from the coalition. I think many of the reasons they highlighted were around, kind of the politics of Miss Takeuchi Sanae. We mentioned last week that she's quite conservative, quite a nationalist figure, and also a lot of it, I think, has to do with the stain of multiple kind of scandals that the Liberal Democratic Party have been facing over the last 3, 4 years, and a number of those scandals obviously ending the leadership of a number of prime ministers. So they've walked away. We now have a situation where the opposition parties are trying to put together a coalition of some of the small parties, and there's many of these. Just put simply for our listeners, there are many of them. I think it's I think about 8 or 9 parties that are in the Diet, which is the name for the Japanese parliament. Certainly if they all came together, they would have a majority. But they're looking for a compromise candidate, and a number of names have been thrown around. One of them is from the smaller opposition party, so the Democratic Party for the People. So the leader of that seems to be thrown around as a potential candidate that they might rally around the opposition parties. But it's politics is in flux, and it's certainly had an impact on the stock market. It's had an impact on the political risk now that investors are factoring in, and it sends a pretty bad message to the rest of the region, because obviously Japan plays a big role in the region. So,
it's really interesting one, Ozan, because obviously we were talking about Takeuchi being the first female leader, and then obviously this split happened, and you got to ask about the politics in the split, because I know they talk about her being conservative or the corruption scandals in recent years, but you know the some of those aren't new, and it's not like they sought to dissolve the coalition government from a minority perspective prior to that. So you do wonder what else is at play, whether it was a negotiation, whether they wanted more government positions as part of, you know, a recasting of the coalition or something. You got to ask, you know, what really under, because the stuff around the corruption or the slush fund and what have you, it doesn't feel sufficiently persuasive to be the actual reason. That's my sense of it. Maybe it is, and the ability of sort of this rainbow opposition to form a coalition, even if they do get the leader of the Democratic Party to sort of step forward as a compromise candidate, you got to think that it's not going to provide stable government for Japan, with, you know, the only unifying point really that they want the Liberal Democratic Party out. So I think this is going to be one to watch, not over the ne not just over the next few weeks, but in next few months, and you know, even to the next couple of years. Japan's going to be fascinating, Borgen-esque in how it might play out with intrigue. So yeah, definitely one to watch.
Yeah, look, I think there's certainly a lot of things happening probably behind the scenes that we're not privy to, and you know, they had been in coalition for quite some time, 26 years, I think, and you know, the Kobe Party is quite a small party compared to the rest of you know, the opposition. I think they hold 21 seats, which is the fourth biggest party in the parliament. So yeah, I think I think there is an ideological element to it. I think a number of factors did play in. You know, I think you know, it's also around how to deal with Japan. Sorry, how to deal with China. I think that's a big issue. There has been some talk around, you know, a harder stance from Japan on China, you know, and this smaller party, I think, traditionally has not had, you know, those types of positions. So I think it's a combination of things, to be honest with you. I think there's no, look, most of it's probably opportunistic as well. You know, maybe they see themselves playing a bigger role in a coalition of the top three opposition parties. You know, and maybe they've seen the writing on the wall, because let's face it, it's one thing becoming the leader of the LDP, but it's another thing with all of the economic social problems that we discussed last time on the show. You know, it's another thing actually winning an election with this coalition. Maybe they've seen the writing on the wall.
Yeah, that type of direction of travel stuff is what tends to split coalitions, and then they scramble about and find what reason they're going to say publicly, but actually it's because of the polls.
I would say that's probably driving it. I mean, they'd be mad not to be driven by the polls in this environment right now.
Well, let's see where that all lands up. Gentlemen, lovely putting things as simply as possible this week again with you. See you next.
Thanks, guys.
Great to be with you. Thank you.